for there could be no doubt of his sex, though the fashion of the time did something to disguise it, was in the act of slicing at the head of a moor which swung from the rafters. It was the colour of an old football, and more or less the shape of one, save for the sunken cheeks and a strand or two of coarse, dry hair, like the hair on a coconut. Orlando's father, or perhaps his grandfather, had struck it from the shoulders of a vast pagan who had started up under the moon in the barbarian fields of Africa. And now it swung, gently, perpetually, in the breeze which never ceased blowing, through the attic rooms of the gigantic house of the lord who had slain him. The skull swung to and fro, for the house at the top of which he lived was so vast that there seemed trapped in it the wind itself, blowing this way, blowing that way, winter and summer. The green arras with the hunters on it moved perpetually. His fathers had been noble since they had been at all. They came out of the northern mists wearing coronets on their heads. Were not the bars of darkness in the room and the yellow pools which checkered the floor made by the sun falling through the stained glass of a vast coat of arms in the window? Orlando stood now in the midst of the yellow body of an heraldic leopard. When he put his hand on the windowsill to push the window open, it was instantly coloured red, blue and yellow like a butterfly's wing. His face as he threw the window open was lit solely by the sun itself. A more candid, sullen face it would be impossible to find. The red of the cheeks was covered with peach down. The down on the lips was only a little thicker than the down on the cheeks. The lips themselves were short and slightly drawn back over teeth of an exquisite and almond whiteness. Nothing disturbed the arrowy nose in its short, tense flight. The hair was dark, the ears small, and fitted closely to the head. He had eyes like drenched violets, so large that the water seemed to have brimmed in them and widened them, and a brow like the swelling of a marble dome pressed between the two blank medallions which were his temples. Orlando slowly drew in his head, sat down at the table, and with a half-conscious air of one doing what they do every day of their lives at this hour, took out a writing book labelled Athelbert, a tragedy in five acts, and dipped an old stained goose quill in the ink. Soon, he had covered 10 pages and more with poetry. He was fluent, evidently, but he was abstract. Vice, crime, misery were the personages of his drama. But all was turned with a fluency and sweetness which, considering his age, he was not yet 17, and that the 16th century had still some years of its course to run, were remarkable enough. At last, however, he came to a halt. He was describing, as all young poets are forever describing, nature. And in order to match the shade of green precisely, he looked, and here he showed more audacity than most, at the thing itself, which happened to be a laurel bush growing beneath the window. After that, of course, he could write no more. Green in nature is one thing, green in literature another. Nature and letters seem to have a natural antipathy. Bring them together and they tear each other to pieces. The shade of green Orlando now saw spoilt his rhyme and split his meter. Moreover, nature has tricks of her own. Once look out of a window at bees among flowers, at a yawning dog, at the sun setting. Once think, how many more suns shall I see set? And one drops the pen, takes one's cloak, strides out of the room, and catches one's foot on a painted chest as one does so. For Orlando was a trifle clumsy. He let himself out at a little gate in the garden wall. He skirted all stables, kennels, breweries, carpenter's shops, wash houses, places where they make tallow candles, kill oxen, forge horseshoes, stitch jerkins. For the house was a town ringing with men at work at their various crafts, and gained the ferny path leading uphill through the park.